Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now we're in depth on how gender is influencing this election. In key voting blocks, in the political discourse, in our perceptions of what gender is. As our guests talk about all of the ways gender is playing out in the election, I want to hear from you, too. Do you see and hear gender being debated and discussed in different ways, with critiques of Hillary Clinton's stamina, Donald Trump's boys' locker room kind of persona, with the way men and women are reacting as voters to the candidates? So I want you to think about this with different dimensions, the way gender is being applied between the candidates to one another. Some of this locker room talk that Donald Trump is being criticized for, where policy fits into this, how voters, men and women, are reacting to the latest news out of the campaigns and the election. I'd like you to think about that and weigh in this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Steph Curtis is at nprnews.org/live. Michelle Cottle is with us. She's a contributing editor at The Atlantic and joining us from Washington. Michelle, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Scott Clement is with us. He's a polling manager for The Washington Post. Scott, welcome. Good to have you on the show as well.
Great to be here, Carrie.
Susan Chira is going to join us a little later. She writes about gender issues for the New York Times and wrote a pretty interesting op-ed that I have read and have been thinking about. Scott, I want to start where voter groups are in the newest polling. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll came out. It was taken after the release of the Trump video, but before the debate. It shows Clinton with an 11-point lead. Here's the interesting part about what's happening with women. Clinton's advantage among women increased to 21 percentage points from 12% in the September Journal NBC survey. Who are these women who are moving? Do you know?
Well, the samples for that survey was particularly small. They were trying to get at immediate reactions, so they didn't break out in detail which types of women were moving from what I read. But before the debate, one thing we found in our surveys were that partisan men and women responded to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in very predictable ways. So Republicans, for instance, both men and women were very unlikely to say Trump was biased against women and minorities. Democrats overwhelmingly were critical of Trump on this front. But independent women, there was a pretty big difference. For instance, we saw that in our September survey, 69% of independent women thought Trump was biased against women and minorities, compared with only 50% of independent men. And what's interesting to me is the vote gap among these groups was not very large. So that meant that independent women weren't necessarily executing on that negative perception of Trump at that point. Mm-hmm. So to me, that said that there is some potential there. Obviously, independents are more mobile in these things. That's one thing we're really trying to answer in the coming days is how much does this pull at partisans who really are well locked into each of the candidates, and how much does it pull on those who were still at least on the fence, maybe not between Clinton and Trump, but between Clinton, Trump, and some of the other candidates, or even staying home.
And Michelle, as I understand this, Donald Trump cannot win without white women. And in fact, because of the demography of the country, he needs a significantly large margin of white women. Is that right? Is that how you understand it?
That is what he has been presented as. I mean, he has obviously a huge problem with any minority voters. And he has a huge problem with single women. You know, the Republican Party traditionally has a problem with single women. So he needs to get those white suburban moms if he has any hope of putting together a large enough coalition.
And where were those white suburban moms, let's say, 10 days ago before this tape?
Well, you know, you have a lot of kind of conservative-leaning or moderate Republican suburban moms who aren't crazy about Hillary Clinton. And so a lot of them were trying to decide who they were going to hold their nose and vote for. So when you have something like this pop up, you know, for a lot of people, this is the tipping point, just like it has been, you know, strikingly the tipping point even for a lot of Republican male politicians.
Scott, remind me where President Obama was with, as I recall, single white women. I mean, women of color, of course, were important for him, but single white women turned out to be important for him. Do I remember that right?
This is a group that Democrats have won in some recent elections. I don't have the statistic on me, but one of the things that's a particular group of women where Democrats have done well. And one thing we're seeing this year, even before the tape, was a slightly larger gender gap than usual. And as you all been talking about, this is particularly concentrated among white voters. We're seeing a deep split by education and also gender. And one challenge, of course, that is that white, better educated women tend to be very high turnout voters.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a group that if you alienate them, you pay a significant price at the polls. And so it's one extra layer, I think, that goes into this is how motivated people will be turned out to support.
Yeah, a call here from Terrence in Minneapolis. Hi, Terrence. What are you thinking about here?
Yes, I was listening to the show. When you guys initially started talking about Hillary Clinton being off the campaign trail, I couldn't help but think about the last two debates, and a few days before the debates, she was gone for days. They said she was prepping, but it was less than 50 days out for the election day, and I couldn't help but notice that's pretty bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And you look online and there's all kinds of stuff. You'll find videos and there's a theory that Hillary has Parkinson's. And I saw videos after the last debate and videos before the debate. And, you know, there's a downtime in which one needs if you're on Parkinson's medication.
Okay, so Terrence, you know, there's no fact to support that, so I don't want to go too deeply into that. And when I brought up this issue of the stamina, I'm saying, how is gender playing in a lot of different dimension here? I mean, Donald Trump has been critiquing her stamina. There's a gender element to that. That there's a gender element to the locker room stuff that he's been saying. There's a gender element to the way voter blocks are responding to that. And Scott and Michelle, let me come back to you. I think Donald Trump has, up until this locker room or this tape, I think he has been very consciously using gender subliminally. I mean, the subtext of a lot of his critique of Hillary Clinton has been gender motivated. Michelle, I'd be interested in your thought on that.
Well, certainly he has been doing kind of dog whistling with that sort of thing. I mean, he's talked a lot about, does she look presidential? What the heck does that mean? I mean, he talks about how he's a strong leader.
Right.
I attended the Women for Trump launch when this group was launching, and the entire parade of speakers, and there weren't that many, but they were talking about how finally we have a man's man. We have somebody who's not going to be bullied. We have somebody who's a real leader. And a lot of these are just kind of playing on people's unconscious bias about what a president is supposed to look like and what he's supposed to sound like and how he's supposed to behave. And it's kind of like a desire to elect your daddy president.
Scott, how do you see voters and different sexes of voters reacting to what Michelle's just described?
Well, it's so fascinating because looking back at the research on, you know, impact of gender in campaigns, it's surprisingly null. And a lot of times the men and women candidates at lower levels of office get covered in similar ways. Voters respond in similar ways. But Michelle's totally right. Both candidates have put this out in front. Trump has criticized her of playing the woman card. And when we asked about this way back in May, it was interesting. 32% said they thought Clinton gets an advantage due to her gender. 29% said Trump. This stuff broke very closely on partisan lines. I think it can be responsible for the somewhat larger gender gap than we've seen before. But I think it's a little surprising to me that people haven't divided more by more by gender. You know, people see a lot in these negatives in both of these candidates.
Right.
And when they see things like that, it's not all clear they're that persuasive. You know, and this goes for, I think, Clinton's appeals as well in trying to claim the mantle or, you know, really benefit from the mantle of being the first woman major party presidential nominee. It hasn't really been a sign that that's rung very strongly with voters. They like her because they're either Democrats or they really dislike Trump.
Let me say a word to some listeners who are calling in unhappy that I use the word locker room banter for Trump. That's how he puts it. I'm not saying that that's how I view what Donald Trump said on that tape. I don't view it like that. But that's what Donald Trump says. So when you're calling to say, why is Kerry calling it locker room? Those are his words. To the phones here to Jane in St. Paul. Hi, Jane.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Kerry. You know, I thought that you hit it right on the nail when you were saying something about that word stamina. And to this point, he uses that word as a code word for female. He has been doing it consistently. And I was watching the debate the other night with three women and two men in the group, and only one was an independent. Admittedly, the rest of us were Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But what someone said, the minute at the end when he was asked, can either of you, or they were asked, can either of you say something kind or nice about the other? And what was his comment? That she's never a quitter.
She never gives up.
She is a fighter.
Right.
And I thought that we all thought that was so contradictory that we started to laugh. That goes in the face of his saying what he said about stamina. And I do wish that we would be aware that that's kind of a code word.
Yeah.
The other thing, I have to remind you, Kerry, you're always fantastic. But when you said that black women, of course, would have been for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You're overlooking, I think, and I happen to be a black woman, but you're overlooking the fact that in the 2008, do you remember where he first won his big first primary? Iowa,
right.
And I lived in Iowa,
good
and
point.
That's the state. That's an area that we wouldn't have a large population of blacks. And by the way, I was, until the end, a Hillary girl. So until she gave up to him, I was one of the people that had known about her, had worked on her behalf since the 1970s.
Jane,
I'm not a reluctant follower of Hillary.
I always appreciate your calls. You know that, Jane. I thank you very much for clearing the record there. I was talking about the general election, but your point is very well taken. Michelle, to what Jane is saying about the way that debate ended Sunday night and a kind of Donald Trump disavowing a lot of the coded language he had used, I think, to bring attention to Hillary Clinton's gender.
I think everybody was struck at how gracious that moment was because we haven't seen a lot of this. And amusingly, this is a line that the Clinton campaign is using for her as well. I mean, this is her big selling point. If you talk to a lot of Clinton advisors, they're like, she's a quitter. You know, she never gives up. She always stands back up and fights. And so it was more than a little ironic that that's the direction he decided to go.
Okay. Call here from Joy in Cannon Falls. Hi, Joy.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
I was noticing, I was reading the Washington Post after the debate, and there was an article written by, they interviewed several body language experts.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back and forth between the two candidates, and they didn't really rate one better than the other. They were fairly neutral in their assessment. And then over the course of the day, and I think it was driven a lot by women on Twitter, the meme of Donald Trump sort of getting into Hillary's face and looming over her became more and more pronounced. But I really do think that it was women who noticed that. And I was sort of struck by the fact that it wasn't picked up so much by the quote-unquote experts in the Washington Post.
Okay. Scott Clement is quote-unquote experts in the Washington Post. Can you say something to that?
Well, I think this this analysis we've been doing in previous debates, I wasn't reporting on it myself, but they had interviewed body language experts to look around at individuals, observe each candidate and how they were behaving. I mean, I think it's an interesting way to look at it and how and dig into how people perceive it and what they're giving off. I think the best way to gauge, who effectiveness or reaction is just to see how people perceive it in the surveys afterward. It takes time, and it's tough when we're really trying to get immediate reaction of what people want. But
it is.
That's one thing. And I think, you know, we saw similar, very different strategies from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in the first debate. And Donald Trump used some of those same strategies again this debate. They're not surefire by any stretch. So while they may be characteristic of, you know, gender roles and things like that, doesn't necessarily mean that they're effective.
I want to bring Susan Chira in now on the conversation because it's this op-ed that she wrote after the debate or after the tape came out that really got me thinking about all the dimensions of gender. She's a senior correspondent and gender issues editor at the New York Times. Susan, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to read a little bit of the op-ed for listeners who didn't catch this about how you're thinking about masculinity and Donald Trump. Here's some of what you said in that op-ed. This election raises the question of what vision of masculinity Americans are going to endorse. Mr. Trump's version clearly resonates with a segment of the American electorate. He tells it like it is. He gets results. Take that, political correctness police. In the primary, he scored by unmanning his opponents. He mocked them as wimps and effete elites, too weak to get through a debate without water, Marco Rubio. And the ultimate insult, not manly enough to attract beautiful women, quote unquote, Ted Cruz. Will you say a bit more about how you've been thinking about this?
Yes, I think this is such a remarkable election because, of course, you knew it would be about gender with a woman running against a man.
Yeah.
But what has been fascinating, in fact, is that we're not only talking about women, we're actually talking a lot about men and what, how men behave, how men think, and how men feel. And what I think is so fascinating about Donald Trump is that, in a way, I spoke to a number of scholars about American masculinity, and he's kind of an exaggeration of conventional American masculinity, if you will. He's larger than life in so many ways, and the way that he has used a kind of hyper-masculinity in this election, you know, if guys talk about girls, Donald Trump's going to talk about women in a way that you've seldom been allowed to listen in on unless you yourself have been the target of sexual harassment, as so many women have written in to say they've been.
You know, I also think what you're saying about the subtle, just the kind of reaction, and maybe some of it's unconscious, from voters who feel that when they say he tells it like it is, he speaks for me, some of that is, and when you look at his voter base, some of that are male voters, white male voters who feel pretty disenfranchised, right, from what's happening with the economy and respond to this idea about there was a time when real men were real men. I mean, they're tapping into that kind of nostalgia that I think Donald Trump is channeling.
I think that's absolutely right. I've been doing some research on the demography of Trump supporters, and it does – there's actually a really interesting controversy about how much of Trump support actually comes from working-class white men. But nonetheless, I think it's clear that culturally there is no doubt that some of what he says resonates to people who feel that they may have been kind of struck twice, once with economic downward mobility and the other with a kind of cultural loss of authority. These are men who used to have enough money so their wives couldn't work, no more. These are men who used to feel that they were the undisputed, you know, sort of rulers of the household. That assumption's been shattered. So I think that there is clearly some resonance for people who feel that they've lost mm-hmm. in a game in which women have won.
Michelle, what does that say to you?
Well, there is a lot of gender anxiety that is at play here. And in fact, there were polls done during the primaries that showed that a lot of Trump supporters heavily believe that traditional gender roles should be stuck to, that women should do what women are suited to do and men, you know, would be better off doing their traditional roles. And so that will be factored in to a lot of the criticisms, you know, especially if Hillary Clinton winds up winning You know, on the other hand, a lot of it will just be that gender is an easy way for political opponents to dismiss her, and there are so many stereotypes and caricatures that can be used in that way as well.
Michelle Cottle with us from The Atlantic today, Scott Clement with us from The Washington Post, and Susan Chira with us from The New York Times, as we examine the way gender, the different dimensions that gender has entered into this political campaign, talking about Susan's op-ed about the hyper-masculinity of Donald Trump, talking about the way Hillary Clinton has navigated gender, used it sometimes to her advantage, ignored it in some other points in her political career. I'm asking you this morning about how you see and hear gender being debated and discussed in different ways. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, at CarrieMPR, Steph Curtis on the page. What do we hear, Steph?
Yeah, Sheila says, Pence kept saying broad-shouldered leadership
did.
At the vice
that.
Presidential debate, and right. Sheila thinks that was alluding to masculinity.
Okay, a call here from Remy in Minneapolis. Hi, Remy. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, what'd you want to say?
You know, I just want to make a comment. I think that this whole idea of hyper-masculinity, to me, I don't define masculinity by these same sort of gender stereotypes. And I think that Trump is revealing actually a masculine inferiority complex through a lot of his behavior and his commentary and trying to relate himself to strong men like Putin, who I think that it actually reveals a sort of inferiority complex, which is, to me, less than masculine.
I think that's a really interesting point, Remy. I appreciate that. We'll pick that up on the other side of the latest news here. Our conversation continues. You can weigh in via Twitter and by phone. We'll get the latest news, and then we'll get right back to our conversation. To Stephen John now. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Carrie. Donald Trump is again attacking House Speaker Paul Ryan. Trump is calling him very weak and ineffective a day after the House Speaker said he would not campaign for the controversial GOP nominee. Ryan told Republican lawmakers on a conference call yesterday that he would focus instead on helping the party keep control of the House. Hillary Clinton says she wants to double the child tax credit and to increase the amount that low-income families could get back in refunds. The Democratic presidential nominee announced her plan today, saying she's trying to help families struggling with the cost of child care, health care, and college. The governor of North Carolina says three more people have died in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. That brings to 14 the number of storm-related deaths in that state alone. The U.S. death toll now stands at 26. Meanwhile, frustration is growing in Haiti, where seaside villages slammed by the hurricane last week are still waiting for food, medicine, and fresh water to arrive. Samsung Electronics says it's pulling the plug on its troubled Galaxy Note 7 smartphones for the sake of consumer safety. The devices, as well as their replacements, had a tendency to burst into flames. Samsung will either provide a full refund or replace Note 7 units with any other model of Samsung phone. Thousands of striking nurses in the Twin Cities have a tentative agreement with the Alina Hospital System. Governor Dayton announced the new deal this morning after a 16-hour session at the governor's residence in St. Paul, aided by federal mediators. The nurses have been on strike at five Alina Health hospitals in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area since Labor Day over issues including health insurance. Some scattered rain showers north and central today. Better chance of rain statewide tonight. This is Minnesota Public Radio News at 9:29.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our listeners and by Destination Medical Center, a strategic initiative to position Minnesota as a premier destination for health and wellness. Learn more at dmc.mn.
Support comes from Minnesota State. Seven universities and 30 colleges, such as Minneapolis Community and Technical College, serving 400,000 students each year to develop talent Minnesota's businesses need to grow. Minnesota State, extraordinary education, exceptional value.
Back to your calls and questions here in just a second, but I do want to remind you what you're hearing this hour, this issue-driven conversation. This is where Minnesota Public Radio News really fits into the election season discussion. You can get the headlines and the horse race in a lot of different ways. This is what we do that we feel is unique. Bring in great guests, really smart people who have been thinking about different ideas and dimensions of this race, and then having an hour-long conversation and inviting you into that. If you can support this, 800-227-2811. Click and join at nprnews.org/donate.
It's our first day of our member drive, so we have a special. We've got NPR custom socks. Any donation in any amount will get you this in addition to any other thank
you
gift. Steph,
you know what? I think we ought to send a pair of socks to all of our guests, to Michelle and Scott and Susan, because they're waiting for us and they're listening through this. Okay?
I'm volunteering to do that. You are a generous person. Right. I'm flabbergasted by this. NPRnews.org/donate to get your own pair of socks. But the more important thing is that you are supporting this station that you rely on, especially during an election season like this election season, any election season where you want to know what's happening regionally and around the country. The moment you wake up, you turn on the radio and you listen all day and you want these in-depth conversations, that's what your membership gets you. 1-800-227-2811 or nprnews.org/donate.
And let me say one more thing about this, because this show is kind of unique in what we do. We invite you in. We welcome the opinion. In fact, the show wouldn't be what it is without you driving the conversation and informing the conversation. So if you're waiting on the phone, don't go away. If you're tweeting in, I love it. I really appreciate the added thoughtfulness that you give us in these election season conversations. 800-227-2811. If you're hanging out on Twitter, I'm just going to say it takes you like 30 seconds to flip on over there to the donate page and click and join. And I'd love it if you did that. NPRnews.org/donate.
And every contribution, again, gets you a pair of socks today. It's an extra special bonus. If you've never been a member before and you're wondering, just try it out. Make a donation. Give it a shot. Become a member, maybe $5 a month, $10 a month, and see how it fits. See if you like it. We'd really love to have you in there. It's a community service that you're helping support. If you want other people around your community to be well-informed during election seasons like now, that is what your money is going to. It's really important. 1-800-227-2811 or nprnews.org/donate.
Okay, back to Michelle and Scott and Susan. Do I owe you each a pair of socks for hanging out with us?
Absolutely.
I would love to wear them.
They're argyle, you guys, so they're even better.
Man.
Let me come back to you, Susan, with what Remy said before we went to the newscast there, which is he thinks we're seeing on display a masculine inferiority complex. Have you thought about that?
I think that's a really interesting point. One of the things that I didn't get a chance to say before, and I examined in my piece, is that in fact, a lot of people reject this concept of masculinity. And when I spoke to scholars of American masculinity, they made the point that was really fascinating, is that hyper-masculinity, in fact, some of them agreed with Remy, that it could be also seen as weakness. But I think even more so, what's interesting is that this idea that men swagger and they boast, that isn't often the case with a traditional idea of a strong, silent man who works with his hands and gets the job done and is actually quite chivalrous toward women. So there's all kinds of images of masculinity. And of course, we would argue that the chivalry image is also outdated.
Yes.
What I think is so interesting is this election is revealing and allowing us to debate which version we as an American electorate agree on.
Helen says on Twitter, Trump demeans men, so many men who are real men that I've known and worked with throughout my personal and working life. Liz in Eagan called in to say she was looking at the number of minutes that Trump and Clinton got to speak during the debate. It was virtually identical. Trump was complaining that Clinton was getting more time, finds it ironic that for men, equality is seen as unfair. Scott, will you remind me what your polling and perhaps some of the other polling is telling us about where men are as they perceive Donald Trump? I know they're a certain part of the electorate is a key part of his base, but tell me more about that.
Sure. So, overall, men have mixed views of Donald Trump. We found they tend to lean unfavorable toward him. That's just much more intense among women. People are much more than their gender, we know, of course. Historically, they've leaned more Republican than women. They've tend to lean, Mitt Romney won men slightly, but Obama won women by a larger margin. And then the types of things that tend to divide men, especially this year, are education and race. The big ones are race. White and Latino men, African-American and Latino men tend to lean heavily toward Hillary Clinton, while white men tend to lean toward Donald Trump. And then among whites, there's a very steep divide between those with college degrees and those who have a lower level of education. They both tend to favor Trump, but those without college degrees tend to be his very best group. Our poll earlier, before the first debate, found that Donald Trump led by a really historic margin among white men without college degrees, something on the order of 50 points. And that's really a major growth from even 2012. This is already a very heavily Republican-leaning group. But Donald Trump has connected with these voters in the primary and again in the general election. I think what we've seen, though, is both among white men and white women, there's been this split along educational lines where Trump's message has connected more with those that lack a college degree, but it's also turned off those who have higher educations. As you go up the educational line, you just see more and more people pulling back. I think you see that in some of the individual states, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Looking across the upper Midwest, you do have large populations of voters who are blue-collar whites, and Trump has shown stronger, better strength among there when he was peaking, at least. Other states, such as Virginia, where I grew up, it has a very big population of whites with college degrees, and that has looked out of reach for Trump for months. This is a state that has voted lockstep with the country for last few elections. So it's just a real sign of how those different demographics have both reacted to Trump, but also how those are going to play out in November.
Hey, Michelle, I'm just interested. We did a show on education and how that's factoring into this election. Is the education difference that Scott just described all about, well, if I don't have a college degree, I feel like I'm just not getting my share in the way the economy works today? Or is there some of this, would you overlay some of this gender stuff that we're talking about among those men without college degrees?
I think you have to look at, for blue-collar workers or people with a lower level of education, these are the very people who feel like they've been left behind by society. You know, a lot of the good jobs have been sent overseas. The whole idea of being this strong traditional provider for your family has been undermined. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible in a lot of places. You know, look at when Donald Trump talks about coal country. He goes up there and you're looking at people whose lifestyles have just completely gone. And they're not coming back for the most part. And that's what he's selling. He's selling this idea that he's going to bring them back a culture and an America where they knew what their place was. Now, that is not true. He is selling them a bill of goods, but that is the dream that he is selling. And so I think that does play a lot into it. It's not just that, oh, you know, I make more money, I've got a better deal, and the system's working better for me. It's a whole identity crisis about what it is to be a provider or where you fit into society, especially among those who have had this kind of more traditional approach.
Susan, it sounds like you've given thought to that as well, given what you said earlier about this idea about I was the one that brought home the bacon in the household and now my wife may make an equal salary, those kinds of things.
Yes, I completely agree with Michelle. I was in Ambridge, Pennsylvania yesterday at a Trump rally, and I spent hours talking to men and women online waiting to get in, and that theme came up repeatedly that even if they themselves were okay, in many cases, these are people who used to have higher paying jobs and they had to train themselves or take lower pay, or they see their kids taking jobs that are lower paid. And they all talked about bring manufacturing back. You know, this service economy doesn't pay enough. And I think that's a very resonant theme. And Mr. Trump absolutely played into that in his campaign rhetoric and his address to the rally. I want to return you. We're bringing coal back. We're bringing steel back. We're going to, again, he was speaking to Pennsylvania specifically, but it resonates in many places across the country.
It kind of what I was saying and what a lot of people have noted about the nostalgic feel to a lot of his campaign rhetoric.
I think that as Michelle was saying, he is promising to reverse economic forces that are really, really hard to reverse. And yet those economic forces deprived a lot of people of a good living where they felt comfortable and, if I may say, like a man. And it's harder to feel all the traits associated with the classic idea of what a man does have been taken away from a segment of the population, and they are reeling, and he is capitalizing on that.
Michelle, you were saying?
It even goes beyond the economics. He is promising a return to a culture that they are more familiar and more comfortable with, where there are not so many Spanish-speaking immigrants making them feel like they are a stranger in their own country, where there aren't Muslims making them feel uncomfortable about, you know, religion. He is promising basically a return to some 1950s ideal that didn't even really exist in the 1950s that goes even beyond their livelihood.
Scott, I'm curious about when your next poll comes out, now that we've had this debate and we're looking at the third one.
Well, I'll only say soon. We are always very quiet about exactly when we do it. Try to be a little secretive about it. But you be sure that we will be pulling
You'll
regularly.
You'll be pulling on some of these things?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on a couple of the comments. One interesting finding from our recent survey, and I know it's a little frustrating. We're talking about all these polls conducted before these latest comments. But we asked a question about whether men and whites separately have too much influence in society, about the right amount of influence, or too little influence. And this, you know, the results were very interesting. I mean, if you think about this, you know, the idea that men to have too much influence is really a declaration that things are unequal, that men have had too much say. And among this group, I've got to pull this up right here, but Trump did especially well among those who said men have about the right amount of influence. His supporters, very few, said that they have too little influence, or at least were willing to express that. And Clinton did especially well among those who said men had too much influence. The difference in Trump's support among those two groups was 52% support among those who said they had about the right amount of influence or too little, and 25% among those who had too much influence. And there was some interesting commentary after he published this piece, particularly among conservatives, pointing to that this is a message that Democrats have embraced to some degree, saying that we need to fight for equality in pay and a bunch of other issues. And this is something that men may be reacting to as well, as these types of messages. Clearly, there's not a direct benefit from that side, but there's that has been a consistent message among Democrats, and they've been really heightened in this campaign.
Really,
so we may be seeing that line of argument, or that just general divide in the public, being accentuated in this campaign.
Back to the callers here, to Carrie in West St. Paul. Carrie, thanks so much for waiting. How are you thinking about this discussion?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I'm a great-grandmother, and this election is really painful for me because of my grandchildren and great-grandkids. But the point I was focused in on after his apology at the debate was how quickly he went to the guy thing and started including all the other men who do this and referencing the fact that this was a general guy thing. It was beyond the locker room. Every time I've seen him quoted in the papers, he talks about other politicians who've done it more or said worse. And in his, it's almost as if he's rationalizing and legitimizing what he said, which completely contradicts the apology.
Thanks very much, Carrie, for the call. Have heard similar sentiment via email and on Twitter here since Sunday night to William in Eden Prairie. Hi, William. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Hey, I was just thinking about this weekend when we were talking with my mother, who's in her 70s, and, you know, thinking about what kind of pulling you had, you know, where somebody that's never, you know, worked and always looked up to the, you know, your father or whatever that did all the work. And so when you ask her, you know, why are you voting for Trump? And she says, well, because he's just going to get it done, you know. So that kind of, you know, instead of just the male, it's like the male's going to do it.
Right.
Versus her looking at Clinton on a different fashion.
Kind of a generational, right, perception of male competency.
Looked at that.
It's good. Susan?
Yes, I think that that's a really interesting question about generational change, if I understood it correctly. And that's one of the things I'm looking for. Attitudes, I'd like to know more about attitudes among younger men, because I think the supposition is that some of these ideas about masculinity may not resonate as much among younger men, even among younger working class men, although I don't know this to be sure. I'm actually still in the middle of doing some research on this matter. So I think you've raised a very provocative and interesting question. Where are we going? What will this election say about where we're going and what we believe in? As Scott was saying, you know, who is going to be steering the cultural and political conversation about this? Who will win politically, but also who will win culturally?
Michelle, I was also struck as Republicans, you know, leapt off the Trump ship, and some of what they were saying about the tape and about women, how awkward a lot of that language was, too. I'm thinking of, and I know they did not mean it like this, but, you know, Paul Ryan talking about we should be revering women. You know, that felt like something out of a different decade to me. So other members of Congress saying, you know, I know women. I have, you know, women in my household. It just, there was also, it was important. I picked up this, how do I say this? This like awkward thing that I thought, there's some things being revealed here that I wouldn't have expected as well. Do you know what I'm saying?
Kind of. I mean, you had them shift from the, they were running so hard away from the vulgar and the sexual and the predatory that they kind of went back to that whole put women on a pedestal.
Yes.
Women are to be, you know,
coddled,
idealized
and, yes,
and coddled and protected from such ugliness. So it clearly put them in a really awkward position, while at the same time you did have a few just completely batty statements like the RNC's Sean Spicer and Senator Jeff Sessions saying, oh, no, I don't even know if that counts as sexual harassment. Everybody does that. So you had two really, it's two sides of the same coin where people were clearly just not comfortable discussing this,
yes,
at all.
Yes, exactly. Yes, Susan, just as you were breaking the code on Trump and his masculinity, I think I was seeing some kind of doors open on thinking that we don't usually see about women. And it was a little surprising. Did you note that?
I did. And in fact, exactly the point that you and Michelle were just making about the a lot of the Republican response was really interesting. It was about my wife and my daughters and my granddaughters. They were speaking of protecting women instead of essentially,
right,
saying, you know, men, this behavior is wrong and men are outraged just as women are outraged. It was just, it was revealing because I think it shows that among a number of Republicans who rushed to distance themselves from these comments, they did so in a frame that also could be called retrograde.
Hmm. So I'm wondering from all three of you here, as we conclude the discussion about how some of this, if Hillary Clinton ends up winning, and let's just acknowledge the polling where we are a month from today, she's in pretty good shape, how you think this influences the way Americans see her post-election. Scott, do you have some thoughts on that?
Sure. So, you know, one thing, big thing I'm interested in watching is whether the country and partisans get polarized along these gender lines. We've seen this with Barack Obama's presidency, where Democrats and Republicans were divided on so many things, but not as much on issues of racial equality and racial justice. That's changed since his presidency, and the parties are now further divided on that. I don't know whether we're going to see that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, but that's one thing I'll be watching. And also, it depends on how, if she gets elected, how Republicans respond as a party. Do they adopt the kind of rhetoric that Donald Trump has, or do they opt for a different thing? I think that has a lot of influence on how people are going to respond to this. They do listen to their leaders.
That is super interesting. Scott, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
Susan, so given what Scott's saying, you'll be listening, if this plays out the way it looks, you'll be listening quite closely for the rhetoric that members of Congress use with Hillary Clinton.
Yes, I think that Scott is making a really important point. It's not only who wins the election, but how the opposition party will act. Will we see an attempt, for example, if Hillary Clinton wins the election, will we see a movement rising among these disaffected supporters who don't believe in the system? Who's going to feed that? Is Trump going to have a show in which he continues to air out grievances? Will certain segments of the Republican Party split? How are we going to talk about gender, and what will it mean if Hillary Clinton does win, and we don't know what will happen, to see a woman occupying an office that is often, that is invariably in the United States, been male? And how does that play out in real time? Whatever happens, it's going to affect the gender conversation.
Boy, I really look forward to what you're writing about that, Susan. I hope you'll come back and talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Michelle, such a pleasure to have you. A final thought on as we look beyond Election Day.
You know, I actually did a big piece on this and talked to all kinds of people who study gender and politics, and I talked to some politicians, and the general consensus is it's going to get ugly because, much like happened with Obama, the gender issue will come to the fore, not just because of anything she tackles, but because it will be a very convenient way for opponents to delegitimize her.
Michelle, always grateful for the time. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely.
Really good to have you. So three insightful guests there informing us and delving into an issue that has been bubbling, I guess, beneath the surface of this election. But here's the opportunity we have on a show like this to take almost an hour and say, let's bring it all out. Let's invite three of the smartest people we can think of to weigh in on this. And then let's open the phone lines and the Twitter channels here and ask you to weigh in. That's what we do every day. That's how we help inform you in an election season like this that just has a lot of chaos. We're trying to bring some clarity here and really dig into some stuff with the amount of time, with the amount of attention that you can't find in a lot of other places. If you can support that, this would be a great moment to do that. NPRnews.org/donate, 800-227-2811. Steph Curtis hanging out with me here.
Hi.
Hey.
So it's the first day of our member drive. As Carrie said, this is a great time to become a member and support Minnesota Public Radio News. Think about when you're going to be stepping into the voting booth this November. Think about how we have prepared you to cast your vote. All the hours of that Carrie Miller has put in and her producers have put in to bring you the best guests from around the country and around our region to inform you about the election, and all the reporters at Minnesota Public Radio News and National Public Radio who have been across the country, across the region, bringing you stories about voters and issues that matter. It's all coming together in November, and you're going to step into that booth to make your vote, and you will be better informed because of Minnesota Public Radio News. And so we're asking you to kind of take a vote today and vote in favor of Minnesota Public Radio News by becoming a member, making a contribution, 1-800-227-2811, or you can go online, nprnews.org/donate.
Steph, still seeing some comments here coming in via Twitter, which I love to do even after a conversation. Love how people are kind of processing it and thinking about Connor saying, I'm a 30-year-old man, not sure I've ever thought about my masculinity. I think it's a dated concept. I don't think it's as dated, Connor, as you think. It's just something that we don't talk about that much. Mm-hmm. So weigh in with me. Leany talking about kind of some of the GOP response to Trump. It felt and sounded patronizing and regressive. At Carrie NPR to weigh in. Online, nprnews.org/donate. You can do both simultaneously. You can be on Twitter. You can tweet me what you're thinking about. And you can donate. Isn't that great the way that works? 800-227-2811.
Before the time gets away from me, I want to make sure I mention our
the
first
socks.
Day special.
How
yes.
I know?
I'm talking. It's a bonus gift that's today only. So I want to keep people. our goal here, Carrie, is to keep people informed.
Yeah.
And I'm keeping them informed of the socks.
Nicely done.
Any donation that you make today,
a gold star
only,
for you, Steph.
Thank you. Any donation that you make today will send you out a bonus gift because of that donation.
Right.
A pair of custom NPR socks. They're very soft. They're argyle. They're very colorful, and you will like them. They're great. And I'm hoping that it's a special incentive for first-time donors, people who maybe you've just discovered, not people, you. Maybe you have just discovered us because of the election and the election coverage. Become a donor now. 1-800-227-2811, nprnews.org/donate.
Why give to NPR News?
Because I want to keep it going. I actually graduated from college, so I started being somebody who was an adult with a job and felt like that was the opportunity to like really put my money where my mouth was and start supporting in a real way. My name is Molly. I live in St. Paul, and I'm a member of Minnesota Public Radio.
You are NPR. Give now at nprnews.org or call 1-800-227-2811.
Christine, Christopher, and Christine, both members of Minnesota Public Radio. Christopher, calling in from Madison, Wisconsin. We moved to Wisconsin 2 months ago and still find that NPR is our home away from home. You can listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. You can always find us at Minnesota Public. That's what I do. nprnews.org/donate, 800-227-2811. Wherever I'm traveling, wherever I am in the country, I'm tuned into public radio. But here's my thing to you. I think Minnesota Public Radio is hard to beat, wherever you are in the country. If you agree with that, if you've had that experience, listen to us and call in now, nprnews.org/donate, 800-227-2811.
It's really, really easy. You go to nprnews.org/donate. There, you're going to enter your information. We're talking address, your name. You choose how much you'd like to donate, and then that's it. You're taking one small step, and that makes you a member, and that's all. If you've never been a member before and you're hesitating because member makes it sound like you've got to go to meetings or there's some obligations or things you need to do, that is it. You donate, you're a member, you're part of this community, and you're helping support this radio service. 1-800-227-2811, nprnews.org. And don't forget that first day special. Today only, every donation gets you a bonus gift of custom socks from Minnesota Public Radio.
I want to do a shout out for the great calls and ideas that came in. I loved it that Remy called. Loved it that Liz took a minute and called in. Love it that Connor is tweeting in and other people are tweeting in this morning. I mean, that the show wouldn't be what it is. And think about how much there is to talk about and how much there is to process. This show couldn't do what it does without you and without you bringing your perspective and your ideas into it. You are such an essential part of what we do every day journalistically. You're also an essential part of what we do every day as a news and information service. We don't want you to forget that. There would be no NPR without you, the public, in public radio. That's the equation here, and it's pretty unique. And I hope that you'll hear that and you'll hear our gratitude. And if it's time to renew or if it's time to step up for the first time to be a member, you take the opportunity now. 651-227-2811. I was about to give the call-in number there online. This is the way that's really quick to get it done. nprnews.org/donate.
Join your friends and neighbors. There are a lot of other people who are just like you, listeners who've contributed, and that's what we need you to become, a contributor right now to keep this station strong. You help make this radio station as good as it can be. 1-800-227-2811 or nprnews.org/donate. Jeez.
Remember, the socks come along with every contribution. They are argyle. They are hip. You need a pair, don't you? nprnews.org/donate. 800-227-2811. And see you on the other side of news.